Taliban roll out their caretaker government, some old faces, some new. We still don't know what it means for how they will rule or how the rest of the world will engage with them.
Pakistan may be happy with this, but I think it's going to make it difficult for Russia, Iran, China, certainly India, to have regular relations with Afghanistan.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the developer of a public safety app for Afghans says people are relying on it for information. The push notifications, kind of unnecessary right now.
The country's a mess or the city's a mess, so we don't really need push notifications to remind us of that.
And if you want to know why the cost of coffee is going up, look to Brazil.
I really do think that we're about to see a very significant change in prices at cafes because of a supply shortage coming out of Brazil.
What that means for Brazilian coffee growers today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us. The Taliban unveiled a few names today in their new caretaker government. The top slots will be shared by an influential religious figure, along with the head of the Taliban's political bureau. Carter Malkasian has been watching the power struggles behind the formation of the new regime. He's lived in Helmand province and advised former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joseph Dunford, on Afghanistan. Malkasian is currently in Arlington, Virginia. I asked him if he saw any signs of tolerance or moderation in the new lineup.
There are some signs of moderation when you look like Baradar being nominated as one of the two first deputies.
Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar.
That's right. And Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund himself, who has been declared the leader of the new government. There is some information in the 90s that he spoke out against the Taliban having a relationship with al-Qaeda. Now, that information is a little bit too sketchy to have a firm sense of what his direction is going to be, but that's a little bit of a reason to be somewhat encouraged. But then on the other hand, you have Sirajuddin Haqqani as Minister of Interior. The Haqqani network has been known to conduct many, many terrorist attacks and suicide bombings inside of Afghanistan. He's killed large numbers of innocent civilians. And the Haqqani network itself is known to have connections to al-Qaeda.
So let's break down that list. Mullah Hassan Akhund is prime minister with Taliban co-founder Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar as deputy. Does that pairing make sense? I mean, these are the guys who are going to presumably run the country, right?
So Muhammad Hassan Akhund is someone that is known as a member of the Taliban, but not a name that would regularly come up in terms of who is running the military campaign or even who might have been directing some of the decisions that were made on the political side of things. Mullah Baradar, he was kind of the favorite by people who were trying to guess who would become the actual leader of the Taliban, but his position as deputy makes sense. He's been deputy for political affairs now. He's going to continue to be a face to the outside world. I think that makes a lot of sense, too.
And Sirajuddin Haqqani, the new acting interior minister, he's head, of course, of the Haqqani Network. It's a U.S.-designated terrorist organization. Haqqani has a $5 million bounty on his head. Does this appointment make it impossible for the U.S. to recognize the new regime?
This appointment is going to make it very difficult for the United States to have relations with the new regime. It's going to make it difficult for some of the surrounding countries also not to be very worried about the new regime. The Haqqani network is known to have close connections with Pakistan. So Pakistan may be happy with this, but I think it's going to make it difficult for Russia, Iran, China, certainly India, to have regular relations with Afghanistan. His appointment as Minister of Interior, that's important. The Minister of Interior controls the police, controls the internal forces within the country. And that's going to be a lot of the Taliban's focus. Their military effort is going to go in that direction, probably more than trying to build an army or something like that to defend from the outside.
So still, we're in kind of a bit of a quandary as to what the answer is to the question, is this the old Taliban or the new Taliban? We often hear that a more moderate wing of the Taliban was living in luxury in Doha, while another wing of leadership with less tolerant views was fighting in the mountains and valleys of Afghanistan for the past 20 years. Is that a useful way of thinking about Taliban leadership divides right now?
I'm not sure it's a terribly useful way to think about that. It's not known how many serious disagreements exist between these groups. And the people that we've seen appointed here, there are a lot from the 90s regime. And even the ones who are not as well known from that time still have roots back then. I mean, if you look at the person in charge of general intelligence, the person in charge of culture, and their person in charge of borders, all three of those were released from Guantanamo. All three of those were people who were deeply involved in the regime in the 1990s. So you have a strong connection there, but then you also have people like Sirajuddin and Yaqub who are of a newer generation but still have these ties to the older generation.
Hmm. Is there any scenario where a woman has a role in this government?
It's not likely. And it's just not likely that the Taliban will be willing to do that.
Even for optics?
Even for optics, it would become very difficult because the optics can be interpreted by certain numbers of their branches as a lack of commitment and a lack of determination.
Carter Malkasian, author of The American War in Afghanistan, A History, and a former political advisor in Helmand Province for the U.S. State Department. Carter, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
The world's largest coffee exporter? Always a good trivia question. That distinction goes to Brazil. Last year, the country saw record production, but not in 2021. Extreme weather has destroyed many coffee plants across Brazil. Michael Fox reports on what that means to producers there and how it could raise the cost of your caffeine fix.
It's a typical weekday afternoon at Red Emma's coffee shop in Baltimore, Maryland. A handful of people sit chatting over wooden tables in the large open dining area. Behind the counter, barista Naji Haynes Follens is making an iced Americano at the machine. She's a member of the workers' co-op that owns and runs the coffee shop and bookstore.
What do I love about coffee? I have ADHD, so stimulants are useful to me. And so if I'm going to focus, like in the morning, I usually am drinking a cup of coffee in order to like keep me a little bit in line.
She says Red Emma's coffee prices have stayed roughly the same recently, but that might not be for long. See, there's a problem, not at Red Emma's, but with the global coffee supply. In late July, southern Brazil was hit by freezing temperatures. Snow blanketed many hillsides, and in coffee regions, frost covered the fields. In this video shared online, a farm worker inspects coffee plants that have been devastated by the frost in the state of Minas Gerais. The leaves are dead and brown. The coffee beans are black and encased in ice.
Nessa propriedade, perdeu 80%. Eu tenho propriedade que perdeu 50%, tem propriedade que perdeu.
On this property, we've lost 80% of the coffee crops, coffee grower Flavio Figueiredo told Reuters. In this region, I think 30 to 40% of the coffee plants have been damaged, he said. Coffee producers estimate that almost 500,000 acres of coffee crops were hit by the frost. It was the worst Brazil had seen in 27 years. Celirio Inácio is the head of the Coffee Industry Brazilian Association.
Então nós estamos num ano, Mike, bem difícil.
This is a really difficult year, he says. We haven't seen anything like this in a long time. But we believe we're adjusting so that next year our harvest isn't as bad as people are projecting, he says. Brazil's coffee crops weren't just hit by the frost. They were also crippled early in the year by drought. People in the industry worry that climate change will create more extreme weather events like these, making coffee production more and more unpredictable.
We have to be thinking about this. It's really in our face, and it can't be ignored.
Nani Fajeda Matthews is a part owner of Thread Coffee Roasters, another co-op in Baltimore which supplies to Red Emma's.
So the top two coffee-producing countries are Vietnam and Brazil. And if either of those two countries have any sort of weather issues or supply issues, it'll affect the entire world market. So we saw that in, I think it was in the 90s, and again now.
In July, the coffee market price spiked to a seven-year high. The price of coffee futures now stands at just under $2 a pound, up 50% from the beginning of the year. Fajeda Matthews says you might not see a rise in prices at your local coffee shop just yet. Right now, the coffee we're drinking was harvested when prices were low. But that is not going to last.
I really do think that we're about to see a very significant change in prices at cafes because of the pandemic, paired with what will be a supply shortage coming out of Brazil.
Pandemic lockdowns upset worldwide trading systems, causing merchants all kinds of headaches.
Existe problema de exportação, mas muito voltado à falta de container.
Coffee industry head Celirio Inácio says we're having export problems with the shortage of shipping containers and now the much higher costs for ocean freight. This also brings uncertainty, he says. Some larger companies like Starbucks say their prices will remain stable for the next year because they purchase coffee beans 12 to 18 months in advance. Meanwhile, many in the Brazilian coffee industry are concerned, not just for this year, but for the next, as it could take Brazilian coffee growers months, potentially years, to get back on their feet if some plants have been permanently damaged. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
El Salvador took a big economic step today. The Central American country became the first in the world to adopt Bitcoin as official currency. Salvadorans can now use Bitcoin at shops, restaurants, and in financial transactions. Anna Catherine Brigida is a journalist there. She's been following the rollout of Bitcoin in El Salvador and joins us from the capital, San Salvador. Anna Catherine, how is the rollout going so far?
So I actually went to a few different businesses to see if they're accepting Bitcoin. I went to a dollar store, a bakery, a place called Don Pollo that sells chicken, and they all said they're not quite ready yet. They're not accepting Bitcoin yet. And then when I got to McDonald's, they are accepting Bitcoin. So they printed out the QR code that I had to scan with my wallet app. But when I scanned the QR code, it said invalid. So I'm not sure. They've been very helpful and they really want to figure out what's wrong. So far, the rollout is a little bit bumpy, I would say.
Yeah, generally, how are Salvadorans reacting to this adoption of Bitcoin?
Generally, it's one of the most unpopular policies of Bukele's time in office. He's been president for a little bit more than 2 years now. So there was a recent survey that showed that about 70% of Salvadorans are against this law. Earlier today, there's a protest in San Salvador, but it's really the first time that people are protesting one of Bukele's policies because he's one of the most popular leaders in the region.
I mean, it's worth mentioning that Bukele took this decision to implement the new currency unilaterally without any input from El Salvador's legislative body. How does that play into the dissatisfaction with the rollout of this Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, now his party has a supermajority in the Legislative Assembly, so he's able to pass a lot of laws without much discussion. But that's what I've been hearing today. One of the big complaints about the law is that it was passed so quickly without actually asking people, you know, if it works for them. And the general consensus is that it doesn't work for most people. And that didn't take into consideration the realities of many Salvadorans who, like I said, you know, some of them don't have cell phones. Some of them are informal vendors. Some of them can't take the risk of the volatility of Bitcoin.
So, Anna Catherine, with President Bukele expanding his powers, how should we understand the Bitcoin story in the context of these political moves?
So this is in a context where people are already starting to be worried about his authoritarian tendencies, about the lack of transparency in some of his policies. And Bitcoin is really sort of the example of how all of these things and all of the way that he has run the government, how it is affecting the average Salvadoran.
And remind us why El Salvador adopted Bitcoin as a currency, official currency, to begin with.
Well, because because Bukele decided that he thought it was a good idea, I would say, to sum it up. I think that is one of the main concerns of everyone is, well, there was never really any explanation of why El Salvador needs this. Why do they need this currency? Why is it going to make things so much better? Why is it going to solve the country's economic problem? So there's never been an explanation in terms of why El Salvador needs this policy. It's something that Bukele announced. It was quickly passed through Congress, and now it's a law that has been put into effect.
So did McDonald's sort out your Bitcoin order yet?
I just paid with a credit card at the end of the day.
Journalist Anna Catherine Brigida in El Salvador, on the day the country adopts Bitcoin as its new currency. Anna Catherine, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Afghanistan today, protests against the Taliban continued in Kabul and other major cities. Taliban militias fired warning shots to break up some of the demonstrations. They also beat some demonstrators with metal rods. The security situation for protesters and Afghans more generally is top of mind for Zahra Wahidi. She's the entrepreneur behind a safety app that helps crowdsource information about security threats, including physical threats, but also power outages and disruptions to public life. The app is called Etisab, which means accountability. Wahidi is a student at Columbia University in New York, and she spoke with The World's Carol Hills.
Sarah, can you give us a sense of what users see when they open your app? I mean, is it kind of like Google Maps, but with things like checkpoints and power outages marked in addition to traffic jams?
Essentially, it is like Google Maps, because Google Maps is a very happy-go-lucky product in the sense that it's supposed to provide you guidance. And we had that kind of similar idea with Ihtisab. What you're seeing is a timeline that provides a list of all of the incidents that have gone on in Kabul City. And at the same time, you're seeing the locations of those pertinent incidents on that map. So the users provided not only information, but an opportunity to give information.
So how have people been using the app since the Taliban took over?
Essentially, it's mostly been information seeking. And what we've noticed is a lot of people have been sending us reports about, can you confirm this timestamp on one of your reports? Can you provide information for the U.S. Embassy? Can you provide information on who I could contact when I get to the airport? And I guess it's just that sense of, you know, I need help. What can you do for me? You know, whereas the push notifications, it was very, very much popular before the Taliban entered. But now it's that the country's a mess or the city's a mess. So we don't really need push notifications to remind us of that.
You're in New York now. Is your staff still in Afghanistan?
Yes, all of them are in Afghanistan. There's about 20 of them. As the development team, our software engineers, our UI UX designers, my team, the one that I manage directly, which is the data entry analysts, the researchers, the translators, they are all in Kabul.
Are any of them trying to evacuate?
All of them are trying to evacuate. And that's what I'm trying to do around the clock now.
Sarah, you're in New York now. You're still in college. I mean, you're working on your app, you're seeing what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan, in touch with friends and coworkers who are pretty scared. And then you're living your life in New York at the same time. What's that like?
I have never felt such debilitating guilt in my entire life. It feels so unfair that I was given this kind of one in a million chance to be able to, you know, come to the U.S. to study at this fantastic institution. And my friends who, you know, I could list you a handful of them who are much more intelligent and much more capable than I am. And they are stuck and they're unable to, you know, reap the benefits of this kind of, you know, education or this kind of city. And I'm trying my best to do what I can. I know my realities, but yeah, it's a horrible feeling. But you know, what the only thing that mitigates it and alleviates it is just working on Ihtisab, trying to do something to alleviate those little anxieties, even if it's like, you know, like a split second anxiety that we can alleviate through the app. That's what keeps me, you know, able to move on a day-to-day basis. Just be a human, I guess.
Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Zara Wahidi is a developer of a public safety app called Ihtisab that's being used by people in Kabul, Afghanistan. She was speaking there with The World's Carol Hills. If you're listening right now on your car radio or on your phone, there's a good chance that you're hearing the sound of my voice thanks to the modern miracle of semiconductors. The very fact that your car is even moving, thank semiconductors. These little microchips are as important to electronics as neurons are to human brains. Without them, a lot of our stuff would not work. But there's currently chaos playing out in one part of the semiconductor supply chain in Asia, and as the world's Patrick Nguyen reports, that's having a ripple effect across the globe.
Creating tiny microchips is complicated. The raw silicone to make the chip might come from quartz mined from a mountain in the U.S. And then some robots in Taiwan or South Korea might stamp that silicon into a microchip. And then an army of workers somewhere else has to make sure each chip works. These days, that somewhere else is often Malaysia, a Southeast Asian country with a huge electronics sector.
If anything happens to the supply from Malaysia, there will be a disruption in the global supply chain.
Seo Hai Wong is president of the Malaysia Semiconductor Industry Association. And Wong says there is a big problem in Malaysian factories right now, the ones that do quality control on microchips before they go into all sorts of stuff, airplanes, smartphones, even someone's pacemaker. In recent months, many of these factories have had to shut down.
As Malaysians deal with its most serious outbreak of COVID-19, the healthcare system is at risk of collapse.
The Delta variant has ripped through Southeast Asia in recent months, in homes, offices, even factories. Now, a microchip factory is a surgically clean place where workers are covered in all sorts of protective gear, Wong says.
They are dressed in lint-free protected gowns, okay?
Lint-free gowns. So debris from a worker's clothing cannot get on the microchips. They wear hoods as well. And they inspect chips in class 1000 rooms, which means lots of air filters. Basically, you can eat off the floor. So it's not easy to spread COVID in those factories. But still,
the challenge to the factory is that they need to prevent positive cases from going into the factory.
Wong says the government will make a plant close down if workers show up with the COVID virus.
So in case like this, you'll be shut down for 10 to 14 days, then it will affect the supply chain again.
And that can cause headaches as far away as Kansas City, where a Ford auto factory plant had to stop making F-150 trucks because it couldn't get microchips from Malaysia. About 1 in 4 microchips shipped to the U.S. goes through Malaysia to make everything from trucks to dishwashers to missiles. And the timing of this COVID surge in Malaysia, a key hub in the supply chain, is bad. There is already a huge global shortage of microchips. That's partly because so many people have been working and studying at home.
They had to work from home, and therefore they need all the equipment that can help them to work from home, including computers, smartphones, and so on.
Wong says people buying loads of new laptops and gear to help them work from home, that was already going to have Malaysian microchip inspectors working on overdrive. This COVID-19 spike, shutting down factories, really does not help. Elon Musk, the maker of Tesla cars, says manufacturers are now ordering as many microchips as they can, like, quote, the toilet paper shortage, but at an epic scale. I asked Wong, if a company needs to order microchips from Malaysia, how bad is the backlog?
The backlog is as much as 3 to 12 months. So if you want to build, you better order your materials way ahead.
Well, here's the good news. Malaysia has prioritized vaccinating electronics workers, an industry with more than 500,000 people. Wong says things will get back to normal soon. But in the meantime, if your Nintendo Switch or Tesla or iPhone is unavailable or strangely expensive, now you know why. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
More stories from around the globe coming your way in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. Severe droughts are paralyzing parts of the globe, including old farmlands in Iraq and Syria. Some farmers there are moving to the cities.
They just plan to leave these areas and desert them because they just can't live on these lands anymore.
And reinforcing the honor system in all of Wikipedia's 300-plus languages ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This week, as we approach the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, we're looking at how the events that day have changed our world over the last 2 decades. As we've seen in Afghanistan this summer, the impact continues. It was just a week and a half ago when a member of ISIS-K blew himself up, killing scores of Afghans and 13 American military at the Kabul airport. On that day, August 26, 2021, President Biden was blunt.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Biden's words echo those of another U.S. president 20 years earlier.
Make no mistake, the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts.
President George W. Bush on September 11th, 2001. And yet what the U.S. understands about terrorist threats has changed dramatically the 20 years between those two moments. We asked Robin Wright to help us unpack what we have learned in that time. She's a foreign affairs analyst and a reporter and joins us from Washington. After the Kabul airport attack, Robin, you wrote in The New Yorker that, quote, the central flaw in U.S. strategy is the belief that military force can eradicate extremist groups or radical ideologies. So how many times since 2001 have you written that sentence?
Well, I've written it actually since the 1980s when President Reagan promised after the suicide bombing of the Marine peacekeepers in Lebanon, that he would get revenge. And of course, Hezbollah, which was responsible for that bombing, is today not only larger, it is one of the most dominant militias in the entire Middle East and is a major political player.
Take us back to August of 2001. Did the U.S. government then have an accurate picture of the biggest threats facing the country?
Not at all. In fact, Condoleezza Rice, who was then the national security advisor to George W. Bush, was scheduled to give a speech at Johns Hopkins University the morning of 9/11, and it was to outline the Bush administration's priorities in foreign policy, and it was largely about missile defense. It had nothing, no references to terrorism, Al-Qaeda, despite the fact that the United States had been attacked at the World Trade Center in 1993, that Al-Qaeda had engaged in these attacks at the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. Al-Qaeda was, for 8 years, a highly visible enemy of the United States that had effectively killed hundreds of Americans and injured thousands more.
You speak with military people, with diplomats, with Americans in and out of government. What do they say about the U.S. mission in Afghanistan and how effective it was at eliminating the threat of Al-Qaeda?
I think the stunning thing is that many in the military, as some of very high levels have said to me, is that the United States never really understood Afghanistan. And I think that personally is mirrored throughout the Middle East. We keep engaging in conflicts, whether it's in Iraq or Syria, historically in Lebanon, and we really don't understand what has spawned extremism, what has spawned the alienation and disillusion with local governments as well as foreign influence. And that in turn has evolved into a dominant political alternative that has changed the global political spectrum.
You've reported, Robin, on the growing strength of groups with extremist ideology in other parts of the world. Give us an example of a group that did not exist in 2001 that you think poses a threat to the U.S. today.
Well, this is the interesting thing. I think the danger of a direct 9/11 type attack against the United States is much diminished. I think the thing we have to worry about is the growing anti-American sentiment 20 years after 9/11. That has not gone away. It's only deepened. And the sense among many throughout the world, including among some of our allies, that the United States is weakened, that we spent $1 trillion, 20 years of war, in which 250,000 people on all sides died. And yet at the end of the day, we had to scurry out of Afghanistan to allow the Taliban to take over. And in the Taliban sweep across Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda operatives were the elite force multipliers. They are the best fighters. They provided intelligence, strategy, and Al-Qaeda today is larger than it was in 9/11.
How has U.S. counterterrorism strategy evolved since the emergence of Al-Qaeda? Are these lessons being learned, do you think?
I think the United States has adapted militarily. It has developed a very impressive drone capability. The danger is, particularly as we withdraw from some of these countries, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq, that when we engage in these over-the-horizon operations, we can strike, use our drones to strike, as we did in Afghanistan, a car that we believe is laden with explosives. The problem is that it also killed at least 10 civilians, 7 of whom were children, that it's much harder to fight militarily the operatives in Afghanistan or beyond when we are using over-the-horizon capabilities. We have eliminated, through drone strikes, airstrikes, the last 4 leaders of ISIS Khorasan, and yet it is as strong as it was 4 years ago, if not stronger.
So in 2001, there were not a lot of eyes on Al-Qaeda, as you said. But if you look at the entire landscape of potential threats to the U.S. and Americans today, what are the top areas of concern, would you say, in 2021?
Well, I think the top areas of concern will be American targets that are maybe not in the homeland, but are American diplomats or the small military teams we have deployed in places like Iraq and Syria, and as well the soft targets, whether it's NGOs or American do-gooders who are out trying to help societies transform. I think the thing that's striking to me, having covered this trend now for almost 40 years, dating back to the Iranian Revolution and the rise of extremist groups in Lebanon, is the fact that in places like Mozambique, I was in Mozambique in 1975 for its independence from Portuguese colonialism. This is a country that's 60% Christian. And the United States last month sanctioned an ISIS affiliate that has taken deep root in Mozambique and that has killed many people. So the challenge for the United States on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 in the aftermath of withdrawing from Afghanistan is finding the tools to deal effectively with the flashpoints that have generated jihadism.
Robin Wright is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and a columnist for The New Yorker, speaking with us about the American response to continuing extremist threats. Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Tomorrow on The World, we look back at another threat that emerged in the days right after 9/11, anthrax sent through the U.S. mail. 20 years later, lessons from the anthrax attacks are taking on a new urgency amid a global pandemic. President Biden is in the Northeast U.S. today, surveying the flood damage from the remnants of Hurricane Ida. In many other parts of the world, it is the opposite situation, drought, which has gripped parts of the Mediterranean down to some of the oldest farmlands on Earth in Iraq and Syria, where a dry winter and widespread irrigation have pushed water levels on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers to record lows. Aid groups say about 12 million people are affected, as Duri Buscarin reports.
Mohammed Fawad, a cattle rancher, was just 2 years into a venture to bring affordable milk to his hometown in Iraq's Anbar province when, seemingly overnight, the cows started dying.
We have brought doctors even from Erbil to look at the cattle because they were okay and they will suddenly die the next day.
He explains the situation through a translator. They found that because of the drought, the water that the cows were drinking had become so salty it was poisoning the livestock.
There were a lot of people who invested in this project, like more than $350,000 of damages. And we had no support from the government, no compensation.
Fawad had to sell his home and now works in construction back in the city, trying to pay his debts. A few hours north in the district of Sinjar, Kasim Ali Azdo says it's become impossible to grow water-intense vegetables like eggplant because there's no humidity to help the seedlings grow.
The melon crops, they were ruined. Even the roses, they had insects. And there were insects on the beans. I've never seen this in my life.
It's a common refrain from drought-affected farmers interviewed by the Norwegian Refugee Council, an aid group that warned last month that a, quote, total collapse of the food system for millions of people is imminent.
You know, we hear stories, same sort of stories. People are desperate.
Samah Hadid works for the organization. She's the head of Middle East advocacy and temporarily based in Erbil. On a Skype call, she explains that bankrupt families have left their farms to find jobs in the city. Hydroelectric power plants, which run on river water, have stopped working, creating blackouts even for people who aren't farmers. And when the river is lower, it concentrates the pollution in the water, making it undrinkable.
They're spending so much money on drinking water, and now they just plan to leave these areas and desert them because they just can't live on these lands anymore.
This drought, the area's worst in decades, is a phenomenon that is happening more often and more severely because of climate change. But the low levels in the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, Hadid says, are also due to upstream dams in Turkey, which are releasing less water than they normally do.
Turkey itself is being hit by the climate crisis and low rainfall, that it really is necessary that Turkey releases more water into those rivers because millions rely on those rivers for their water sources, their crop production and agricultural production as well.
Turkey has built more than 500 dams in the past 2 decades, which to the Turkish government is a mark of prosperity and development in the arid southeast. But officials from neighboring countries claim that Turkey is using these dams to hoard water and not release enough of it downstream. Turkish officials reject these claims.
Every time, Turkey is trying to explain that Turkey is not using the water as a weapon.
Water as a weapon. That's Dursun Yildiz, president of the Ankara-based Hydropolitics Association. He says most of Turkey's large dams are hydroelectric dams, which do carry environmental impacts, but don't necessarily consume a lot of water. To him, the bigger issue is that there are few clear agreements between the countries on how the water is shared, Efforts to establish rules in the past were unsuccessful.
I'm not saying all these things to blame the neighboring countries. I mean, what I'm saying right now is that now we have no time to lose.
This region has always had water shortages, Yildiz says, but things are likely to get worse from here without serious steps to make the region's water systems more efficient. But that may come too late for many of Iraq's farmers. In Nineveh, Mohammed Ibrahim Hassan says whole swaths of his wheat and barley crops have failed. To adapt, he digs deeper wells, tapping into groundwater that likely won't replenish itself for generations to come. He says that in the past, the water levels below ground would drop about 3 feet a year. But today, it'll drop 15 or 20 feet. Still, they keep digging, an investment few farmers can afford. I wish you could come and see it, he says. You might think I'm giving you an exaggerated picture, but I'm not. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
I confess, when I need to get the basic contours of a story, Wikipedia can be a time saver. I know I'm not alone. Wikipedia has 323 language editions, so a lot of people everywhere are benefiting from crowdsourced intelligence. What Wikipedia is not so good at, there's little consistency across most of those languages when it comes to the quality and accuracy of the entries. There are predictable differences. Spanish Wikipedia, for example, refers to Catalonia as a Spanish autonomous community, but Catalan Wikipedia declares Catalonia to be its own country. Then there are also the insidious differences when editors in a language other than English use a platform to give oxygen to extremist views. Denny Vrandicic is trying to figure out how to correct these problems. He's head of special projects at the Wikimedia Foundation, the nonprofit that owns and operates Wikipedia. Denny joins us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Let's get to the why of this problem. First of all, Denny, English is the dominant language on Wikipedia. How many editors or Wikipedians does it have working on it?
English Wikipedia has about 35,000 active Wikipedians. This means people who are contributing more than 5 edits every month. And it's actually it's several hundred thousand who contribute in general. So there's a really large community of people contributing to the English Wikipedia.
So you clearly need eyes and minds to keep the facts straight, especially if you've got 323 languages other than English. How do you propose synchronizing the quality of languages on Wikipedia to weed out disinformation or misinformation?
Right now, the thing is that we are splitting a lot of energy across those 300 languages that we support. We want to create one single representation, one common representation, language-independent representation of the content that can then be easily translated into the languages of the Wikipedias. And this content then would come from a much larger community that makes sure that it's consistent, that it's fair, that it's a neutral point of view being represented in the content, that it's correct, that it doesn't have errors, and then have this available as a kind of baseline of knowledge to all the different language editions of Wikipedia that want to participate in this. So our goal is really to create a platform where everyone can contribute to those coding tasks, to those translation tasks, without necessarily already being a developer, without necessarily already being a coder. This is our big challenge, and this is where we want to be.
So if I get you, then you're talking about an algorithm that will take kind of like this free-floating universe of facts, and I'm using air quotes here on facts, and systemize it, making it kind of universally accurate?
Making it universally accessible in different languages. Whether it is accurate or not, this is something that we don't promise to do automatically, obviously, because there's no algorithm to check for correctness, right? There's no algorithm to check for truth. The idea here is that by making it available in many, many different languages, there will be a lot of people who will actually be able to see this, and they can then click the edit button and say, no, this is not right, or this is right. The same way that we're doing it on Wikipedia now, and it works for the big Wikipedias that have a lot of contributors, but does not necessarily work for smaller Wikipedias because there's simply not enough people to see all the content, to check the content, to improve the content.
When you say smaller Wikipedias, you're talking about languages that are not spoken by that many people, I assume.
And particularly for languages where we don't have that many contributors to the Wikipedias. Sometimes there are languages that have tens of millions of speakers, like Hausa or Igbo, but we don't have that many contributors on the Wikipedias. Exactly.
So given that until now, each language version of Wikipedia has been its own project operating largely independently, how will you get the editors of all the hundreds of languages on Wikipedia to work together?
Abstract Wikipedia will be an offering to those communities, and they will be able to decide whether they want to take it up or not.
If it's voluntary, though, ultimately, how can it be effective? I mean, it sounds ultimately like the editors are on the honor system.
Yes, that's right. And we won't be changing that. It will remain a volunteering system.
In the end, Danny, is this a problem computer science will solve, or is it ultimately a problem of people in politics?
It's a problem of people in politics. The computer science behind it is well understood. We're not developing much new things here. It's really, how do we manage to get people who don't even necessarily speak the same language to work together effectively, to work on knowledge together, to agree on the contents, and to make it accessible to everyone. And this is something that the community will do autonomously, that they will figure out how to work together, and we provide them a platform that allows them to work there.
Danny Vrandacic is head of special projects at the Wikimedia Foundation, the nonprofit that owns and operates Wikipedia. Danny, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's another impact of the pandemic. Authoritarianism and extremism seem to be surging across the globe. Luke Cooper has been tracking this. He's an associate researcher at the London School of Economics and the author of a new book called Authoritarian Contagion. He joins us from London. To be clear, Luke, your book is not about disease contagion, but contagion as a metaphor for how authoritarianism spreads. So let's get meta here. How has authoritarianism been on the rise through this highly contagious disease, COVID-19?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they replicate in very different ways. I mean, for a start, I think the current rise of authoritarianism as a phenomenon, which is almost universal across the world, it does pre-exist coronavirus. And in some ways, the jury is still out on how exactly coronavirus is going to impact it. The pandemic is still going on. And the mix of policies that you've seen from different governments all over the world, we can't identify one clear case that authoritarianism is green-lighted by the coronavirus pandemic or it's been thrown into decline. It's a much more variable mix. So COVID-19 has been a really kind of complicated issue for the rise of authoritarianism. It's still not quite clear how exactly it will play out.
So I want to get to China, but maybe you can give me an example, the kind of policy you just talked about that you believe could have accelerated authoritarianism, the kind of policy around COVID.
So this does normalize a level of state intervention into people's individual personal liberties, their deeply felt personal liberties, that is clearly historically, I think, unprecedented in many societies, not all. So that is something that we should be concerned about to some degree. I think it's necessary to have that attempt to suppress the virus, or was necessary before there were vaccines. But we should be cautious around whether we're introducing mechanisms that were introduced in an exceptional environment that then become semi-permanent.
Yeah, so a lot of things converging, authoritarianism, disease, privacy issues. Let me just ask you, what do you see as the risk of obligatory vaccine passports in this discussion?
I suppose what the questions that we need to ask about it is the way that I would frame my response. So who controls the information? How is it allowed to be used? What kind of democratic scrutiny do citizens have? And what kind of rights as individuals do citizens have over how their information is used? So I would just basically counsel caution on vaccine passports rather than say a big flat and categorical no to them.
So, Luke, if you look at China, the deaths, the reported ones anyway, are among the lowest in the world per capita. We know China is an authoritarian state, but are those low numbers a result of authoritarianism or simply good governance?
I think they used that very strong institutional structures that they've built extremely effectively to protect public health. And so did their very totalitarian model help them? Yes, I think it probably did, because when you say to citizens in Wuhan and the government says to them, you can't leave your house at all, and we're going to monitor this on a street by street level with local teams, that's something that in a totalitarian society is much more culturally acceptable to the population than it would be in a democratic society. So I would be very cautious about upholding China as a model. But of course, there is something that we can learn not only from China, but also democratic societies like Taiwan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, that at least in the first phase of the pandemic were much more effective at suppressing the virus.
I'm speaking with researcher Luke Cooper at the London School of Economics about the rise of authoritarianism during the pandemic. Is there a country, Luke, that you've seen has clearly become more authoritarian during the pandemic?
I think the huge power that Orbán in Hungary has gave to himself under the auspices of coronavirus is something that we should be worried about. But to be honest, he was looking for any opportunity to give himself more power. It's a very, very authoritarian government.
I mean, it does show the slippery slope of where we are in this moment. Where exactly would you say this leaves democracy? Can it be restored in some of the places where it seems to be retreating?
Yeah, well, I suppose in some ways, you guys in across the pond are the big test question or the case study that everyone is looking at. I think that there are features of the new authoritarianism that Donald Trump's government in the US really closely encapsulated. So what the Biden administration is now tasked with doing is to try to say, well, look, can we protect American democracy from this ongoing threat? And what's the best way to do that? And I think in some ways, we're all looking at the United States to see whether kind of the social justice agenda, the economic agenda can be strong enough that it really rebuilds the legitimacy of the democratic project, as it were.
So what should stronger democracies like the US and others be doing to empower democratic values around the world? Sounds like that's where the hope lies.
Yeah, I think in some ways it is. For example, the proposal that they've made at the World Trade Organization to suspend patents on coronavirus vaccines, I think that's hugely important because democracy, if it's going to mean anything, has to be able to deliver social justice and public health for the populations of the entire world on a universal basis. And at the moment, we have a terrible vaccine apartheid situation where most of the wealthy world is either vaccinated or going to be vaccinated quite soon, and the poorest countries in the world aren't vaccinated. So I very much welcome Biden coming behind a people's vaccine, but those are the kinds of policies that I would like to see Democrats putting forward.
So the people's vaccine, does that in some way promote obligatory vaccination? And is that in line with values of democracy like individual freedom?
I'm not keen on the idea of obligatory vaccination. I'm not sure about it ethically, and I'm not sure about it practically either. So if you choose not to be vaccinated, unfortunately, it's not just a personal choice, because you're making it more likely that the virus will spread. So your personal choice does affect other people. So it's not an easy issue. And I don't think the people's vaccine promotes obligatory vaccination. It's rather giving everyone in the world the opportunity to have the vaccination. And that's the crucial difference. So I would promote consent rather than coercion, but we've got to make sure that everyone has access to this vaccine in the first place.
Luke Cooper is an associate researcher at the London School of Economics and the author of the new book, Authoritarian Contagion. Luke, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's where we sign off today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.